David, welcome to Waterstones.
Thank you.
You are dropping truth bombs from the very opening of this book, where you make it very clear that King Arthur is just made up.
He is just made up. Yeah, that's, I mean, it just, it's pretty clear he's just made up. A lot of people talk about who, you know, there must be something in it, because people have talked about King Arthur. There's so much written about King Arthur, much, you know, so surely that's based on something. But there's no evidence for anything. You know, obviously there were people alive at the time they claim one of those people was King Arthur. Mm-hmm. So if you could say he's based on someone with a different name and an entirely different job description, but then on what level is that existing? That's just someone different.
Yeah.
But obviously he's the ideal king. That's the point, and so that's why. There's no need for him to be based on anyone real. Mm. The need was to have this ideal represented, this thing to hark back to, because through most of the period covered by my book, people they don't believe in the future. They don't believe in improvement. They believe in returning to a lost ideal. It's very Garden of Eden-y.
Yes.
Not that they're suggesting that King Arthur went around with his tackle out.
Well, no. But although
he could have been based on someone who did. A sort of nudist nutter. So yeah, that's, we call him King Arthur.
He's always like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. This, as you say, there is this sort of idea always of restoration, of going back to some great thing. And of course, we still live in an era where people talk about making America great again and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So it's an alluring idea, of course. But you do go through, I suppose, those early English kings. I'm saying English, of course, the idea of England didn't really exist back then. But there is still quite scant knowledge about them. We know bits about the Ethelreds and things like that, but it's still quite sparse information. But you make a really good point, which is that those early kings are basically successful bullies. It's about somebody saying, I'm in charge here, and running with it.
Yeah, well, nothing was written during the period after the Romans had gone until quite far into the Anglo-Saxon era. Nothing's written down, so we don't know what's going on. We know there was a Roman Empire. We know that that was written down. We know they built a lot of stuff, and then it started to collapse, and the legions went home, and that the people who were living in Britain then, who we now refer to as the Romano-British, and gradually morphed into being the Celts, they were not very prepared for self-government, and the Anglo-Saxon tribes started to arrive and took over. But they didn't take over in any organized way. By the middle of the Anglo-Saxon period, you've got sort of seven or eight kingdoms, sometimes referred to as the Anglo-Saxon Heptarchy. But it wasn't like they came and set up seven kingdoms and said, well, I have one here, and, you know, one day we can name counties after them. It coalesced into that. We don't know much about the process of that coalescing, but it was probably, I say in the book, it's more akin to how the selling of drugs is organized in the greater LA area than anything more sort of regal and organized. And yeah, there will have been bullies, and they pushed people over harder than other people pushed people over, so they started to be in charge, and then other more bullying regional bullies became in charge of the local bullies, and that gradually turned into kingdoms, and people sought protection from the local hard man, and that's protection in both the mafia sense and the general sense. And that's probably where English kingship came from. Obviously there were kings before, the Romans had kings, there are kings in the Bible, but our version of kingship came out of that. And then later, when the Anglo-Saxons had converted to Christianity, they started to use Christianity as a basis for kingship. They started saying they needed to be crowned and anointed, and that God was very much in favor of them being in charge, which is a canny thing to do if you want to stay in charge. Say, yeah, no, there's a huge, omnipotent, supreme being, and he's on my side.
Yeah.
But it's, yes, it started with fights. Fights in the mud.
I mean, a big fight, I suppose, is what a lot of people will alight on at school as being the sort of, I suppose, the foundation of what we think of as the monarchy, which is 1066, the Battle of Hastings, all that sort of stuff. It's an incredibly important event for many of those reasons, but you will know far more about this than I do. So why was 1066 so important?
Well, it changed the people who ran the country. It came at you know, what turned out to be the end of what we call the Anglo-Saxon era. And the Anglo-Saxons hadn't had an easy ride. They'd had to deal with the Vikings. But they pretty much sort of had dealt with the Vikings, and the Kingdom of England grew out of the Anglo-Saxon response to the Vikings, and their heptarchy was overthrown, really. But then they got together, and, you know, by 1066, there you've got England with an Anglo-Saxon king, an Anglo-Saxon monarchy, you know, super sorted. But then William the Conqueror invaded, and he wasn't called that then, so they didn't know that they needed to worry. And he took over, and he really took over. He claimed to be the legitimate king. He claimed that Edward the Confessor, who was the king before Harold of Hastings, had said he can be king. We don't know if he'd said that. Mm. He might have done. But whether he did or not, William did something that Edward didn't have in mind, which is entirely replace the Anglo-Saxon ruling class. Mm. So it's a big change. Everyone who's in charge of anything, so anyone who we might have heard of now, because obviously most people leave no records at that time, is essentially dead or out of a job or, you know, driven out. And a new aristocracy and monarchy of people who are themselves descended from Vikings but have been living in France for several hundred of years. Mm. They're in charge, and they're speaking French. And everyone running England spoke French for hundreds of years. And the, you know, most of the people, the people farming the land, they didn't speak French.
No.
But the people, anyone with any power, spoke French. And that must have felt weird. I think I say in the book, we sometimes, worry about, and rightly worry about the fact that a lot of cabinet ministers went to Eton. We feel to be ruled by a sort of select, separate section of society. Well, that's nothing to what happened for hundreds of years, because they didn't speak the same language as all of the rest of the people. They were clearly different, and they built castles everywhere. There were no castles in England before William the Conqueror came, and he put 500 castles up everywhere, telling the locals, you'd better, you know, keep your nose clean, because we're in charge now.
Yeah, except in French.
Yes, exactly.
It's clear from hearing you talk and also from reading the book that you have this passion and enthusiasm for history. You sort of hint in the book that it was maybe not so much that you loved history, but that you just liked it more than the other subjects that you hated at school. But there must have been some enthusiasm there early, or a teacher perhaps who kind of piqued your interest, or was it always just the source material?
No, I always loved doing history at school, but I've always been drawn to old things.
Yeah.
I liked, castles, and I liked old cars more than new cars. And there's something about what happened before, about age, about, you know, we've been in, you know, we're in this room at the top of Waterstones in Piccadilly, and I'm hyper conscious that this used to be a department store called Simpsons. Yeah. And I was sort of, what was it like when it was that department store? And there are pictures on the walls of, you know, and I'm drawn to that. And I was taught well at school. I had several good history teachers, and that, you know, they seemed to strike the right balance between conveying some key facts but also explaining how we know about the past, and explaining that history isn't just an agreed upon description that's been passed down. It's only what remains and what we've inferred from it, but also not dwelling on that too long and sitting down and saying, but basically it is this.
Yeah.
You know. But yes, it's the explanation for our current existence that most appeals to me. Some people are drawn to saying, I want to work out how the molecules interact. Mm. Some people, want to know why nature is as it is. I want to know what the people were doing earlier.
Yeah. There's. I'm going to jump us forward a little bit, because it's a really good example of what remains and then how people sort of infer things from it. Magna Carta, obviously a hugely important moment. With the sort of successful bullies that we've mentioned, taking power, Magna Carta is, I suppose, a check on that power. Mm. And the beginning of what we now know of as being sort of parliament and sort of some kind of representation. And it's important because you have these two things, which is, one is this idea of the royal succession, which of course didn't exist initially. It's an idea that came along. But you point out that if you have this succession, especially by primogeniture, you have, it gives you stability, so that when one king dies, you know what's happening next. There's not a big civil war, there's not a big battle about
yes.
it. And then with Magna Carta and Parliament, you also have this kind of check on that power, which is that you hopefully will avoid tyranny if there are people who are there to sort of control. So that's why Magna Carta is so important.
Yes, I mean, it's because it's the Anglo-Saxons were, in the late period of their kingship, they didn't have a line of succession. They didn't have primogeniture. They had royal families, but a king would have lots of children and they'd have a bit of a fight when the king died about who'd be king next. And those bits of a fight were a problem. That wasn't nice for the people living in the country, those fights. When primogeniture gets over that, you know who the next one is. But the downside is it could be someone entirely unfit for the job. And the Anglo-Saxon system, you did tend to get a more competent person emerging from that horrible fight. So King John, who was the king when Magna Carta happened, he was very much unfit for the job. And yet he was king by, he was crowned, and he was it was arguable whether he was king by primogeniture, but by the time of Magna Carta, it wasn't arguable because he had personally murdered the other claimant. So, you know, that's dealt with. But the barons are thinking there's no doubt he is the king, but he doesn't seem to be very nice or good at it, and this is intolerable. And they really were scratching around, what do you do? You're supposed to obey your anointed king. That's what God wants. And by this stage, the whole gangs bullying thing from centuries earlier is forgotten. The kings believe their own hype. They think they're a little bit holy and should be in charge. And so do the barons. And Magna Carta is this awkward way of sort of saying, yes, you are the king, but maybe you should govern within certain boundaries and the laws you make should also apply to you. And we're very, very proud of it now as at the beginning of liberty and all that. But it's a colossal fudge. It's a sign that the system that they've come to believe in of divine providence, essentially, isn't working. And if you've believed in divine providence and then divine providence stops working, that's incredibly destabilized. It's like losing your mobile phone.
Surely not that bad.
Yeah, exactly. You know how you lose your mobile phone and you feel like the world's all wrong? Yeah, that's how they will have felt. And Magna Carta came out of that. And it didn't work at all in the short term, but it was the beginning of a structure that reigns in kingship, and the next phase was Parliament.
There were several drafts, of course, of Magna Carta, but there were different versions of it. And one of the things you point out, I remember this during lockdown, there were some people who were stomping around saying that they didn't have to wear masks or obey the Queen or something because they were under the charge of the barons and they were respecting Magna Carta or something like that.
Yes.
And as you point out, that's wrong on so many levels. It was in one draft, it only applied to the barons, and was never law in any case at any time.
Yeah. So yes, it was a clause of Magna Carta. It only exists in the first version that was officially repudiated several weeks later.
Yeah.
And the version that later went onto the statute book didn't include it. And yes, it only applied to barons, not everyone. But also, it wasn't. So it was a sort of ridiculous scratching around for an excuse to disobey the law.
There's quite a lot of it at the moment. There's a lot of people who think they'll find a law that, you know, was in existence several hundred years ago that means that they don't have to do something that everybody else accepts that they have to do for the greater good. You know.
Yes. No. Yes. I think the law. I mean, the law of in this country is weird in a way. It's not codified. There's all sorts of things on the statute, but in general, it's pretty clear. Each act of Parliament wipes out previous ones that contradict it, and you can't. You know. But you know. Well done for having a go.
It's a good effort. It's a good effort. Without wanting to ping around too much in history, but I'm going to sort of jump forward. I have a real fascination with the Wars of the Roses, but that mainly actually comes from reading the plays of Shakespeare that deal with that period, which of course aren't historically accurate. They're dramatically fantastic.
Yeah.
But it's an amazing period because there's this idea of these sort of two battling houses, and then we've got Richard III, who's a fantastic baddie, and all the rest of it. But even without that sort of drama in the plays, it was a very tumultuous time in real history.
Yes, and it's so much of it comes from, because of the decline in belief in the office of king and the whole this stability that comes from primogeniture, which is the massive upside, and then some of the people who are then king is the massive downside. But that's all been weakened, really, and the point it gets first point when it gets weakened is when Richard II, who is a terrible king but is undoubtedly the legitimate king, they just can't bear him, and he gets usurped, he gets replaced, and Henry IV comes in, who isn't the rightful king, isn't the rightful next king, but when he takes over, Richard II's still alive, and people are uncomfortable with that, so Richard II has to be induced into not being alive, and it's not clear how that happened, and nobody wants to kill an anointed king, so he was probably starved, which isn't, you know, is a bit bleak. They probably said, well, I'm not gonna chop his head off, but I tell you what, let's just lock the door and walk away. And so that, you know, that's how he died. And then Henry IV, and then people still thought he was alive for ages, and Henry IV had to show everyone the body. And it, but from then on, really, something has been weakened. So you then have Henry IV, who just about keeps it together for his reign, despite several rebellions, mainly from the people who supported his initial taking over, which is another thing. If you support a usurper, you expect the usurper to do everything you want. You know, you're a major investor and you want the profits. So but he just about hung on. Then his son, Henry V, he's a very capable king, great at war, brutal, brutal man. But anyway, so that's fine for a bit. But then he dies of dysentery quite suddenly. And then his not even toddler of a child, 9-month-old child who he's never met, is then supposedly king of both England and France. And then things really start to unravel, because unfortunately that king, when he reaches adulthood, becomes no more competent as a ruler than he was at the age of 9 months. And so that the belief in this new royal house of Lancaster that has sort of started to bed in because Henry V is so great is then whittled away through Henry VI's long reign, and that descends into the Wars of the Roses with a rival claimant from a different branch of the same Plantagenet family. But that couldn't have happened, really. Even the incompetence of Henry VI wouldn't probably have been enough if it hadn't been for this decision that was taken in the reign of Richard II, and they never get it back.
Yeah.
And that's, in a way, as important a building block of our modern democracy as Magna Carta or Parliament, just the fact that you do a couple of usurpations and you can't really believe that the king is the king in the same way again.
Yeah.
So when the Tudors come in, I mean, they've got, as I said in the book, they've got a bit of royal blood, but so is Josh Widdicombe. You know, it's they're not in any way supposed to be the kings, and yet they kind of say, well, we are, so, you know, deal with it.
I hope you haven't just given Josh Widdicombe some ideas about what he could... There'll be another usurpation that none of us are ready for. You mentioned there Richard II, and in, again, going back to Shakespeare, he has this amazing speech where he talks about kingship.
Yes.
And as you say in the book, it's far better than anything he ever did as king.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's really interesting because you, in deciding where to finish this book, you do sort of finish it when we get to the era of Shakespeare. Could you tell me a bit about why that's the case, why you decided to end the book there, and why there's that change with sort of Henry VIII and the Tudors coming in?
With the sort of diminution of the significance of the monarch as a political figure, comes this realization that they're not really magically anointed by God. And it was interesting to me that that comes at the same time as Shakespeare.
Yeah.
And because if there is a God, and I don't know, he is anointed by God because he's a genius. And the way, you know, so much of our historical understanding is infused by his dramatizing of those periods with whatever inaccuracy, he nevertheless brings them to life and is a cleverer man by far than any ruler the country had before or probably since. So it feels like it's a turning point into a more sophisticated time when the Elizabethan drama is flowering, particularly his voice. And that speech that he writes for Richard II is sort of sums up the paradox of kingship, you know, so much better than anyone else ever has, and certainly than any king ever really could. Sort of think, well, that's a full stop on this era of government.
If you don't mind, I'm going to bring us right up to the present day, because of course we've had quite a lot of focus on the British royal family in recent years with the death of the Queen, the crowning of King Charles. And I suppose particularly where we are right now in Piccadilly, there's been this sort of huge pageantry and flags flying everywhere, and it sort of brings into focus this idea of why we still have a royal family, given that we all accept that they're not anointed by God and all that sort of stuff. Why do you think they endure? And if it's not too big a question, how much longer do you think they will endure?
Well, I think they endure because we're obsessed with history in this country, and we like continuity, and we like we want to change things to exactly the extent that we feel is necessary and provably for the better. So it's a prudence. It's slightly backward looking in a sense, but then we don't know the future and we do know the past. So I feel I'm content that we're a constitutional monarchy. I'm not a Republican, and I wouldn't necessarily back our current bunch of politicians to frame a new constitution that would be better than the one we have now. And we've always changed things incrementally, and there's room for future incremental change. But I would say that the flaws in our state are many, and I don't think the way we appoint our head of state is a big problem at all. We have other huge problems. And there's something that works very well for me about a constitutional monarchy, because the person who is nominally most important has no power. And the person who has the most power, still there's someone they're supposed to essentially defer to.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite good psychologically for the people with the power. I always find it's a very odd situation the Americans find themselves in, where showing disrespect for the president can sometimes be seen as showing disrespect for the notion of the state. And when you have a president like Trump, that's problematic, because you have to be able to show disrespect to him. Whereas if you separate the two, then you don't run into those difficulties. So in terms of how much longer it can last, I don't know. But I hope we change our electoral system before we start wasting time changing figureheads.
Fair enough. They're safe for the moment.
They're safe from me.
Safe from you. David, it's been fantastic to speak to you about Unruly. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.